Tonight on Arena, we review three new films. The sublime fiddler Queeveen O'Reilly will be performing live, and we look back at the music of pop legend Scott Walker. I am Rick O'Shea. 5151 is our text number. At RTE Arena is the handle on X. You can watch the programme live at rte.ie/arena, although I have no idea why you'd want to do that. Tonight on our film reviews, Australian shark horror gore fest Dangerous Animals sees hapless tourists on the Gold Coast try their damnedest not to become fish food. We'll also be talking about the documentary The Encampments, about the pro-Palestinian protest at Columbia University and the controversial way in which they were suppressed, and Goebbels and the Führer is a somber drama which tells the story of one of the key relationships at the dark heart of the Third Reich. So it's all lightness and fluffiness and happiness tonight on our movie reviews. Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton have been to the movies for Arena, and they both join me now. We'll start with Dangerous Animals from director Sean Byrne. Paul,
yeah.
It's one of the most Australian horror concepts you can think of, a serial killer who's obsessed with sharks.
It certainly is, and that is what it does. It says what it's going to do, and in fact it really advertises the fact that it's going to become unpleasant from very early on. I mean, you can't talk about this film without hiding the fact that he is a maniac. He has this ratty old boat that he brings tourists out on into the cage, and he makes a serial killer joke on the dock before they set out. This young couple who've barely met each other.
He says, "Oh, so no one knows you're here." Yeah, raised eyebrows, yeah, titters in the audience. So, we know what you're up to.
Yeah, so it's having a laugh, and Jay Courtney plays this guy Tucker, or Taka as he says, and he is larger than life. He's quite funny. He takes them out, and of course, bad things happen. He is in a sense the main character, but the protagonist, I suppose, is this American surfer Zephyr, who's played by Hassie Harrison, who is a loner, we're told, very carefully foster home raised, so doesn't like to form attachments, has a one night stand with this handsome person who's going to be very nice to look at later on, and then is abducted. So he's the only one who knows she's missing. She's on the boat, she's in trouble, but she's a fighter.
It's always that moment at the beginning of a film like this where somebody like that does that. Oh, you're all on your own. And everybody in the audience is screaming. I mean, there'd be no film for the rest of us.
No, it would be very short. And as I say, we saw it last night. It knows what it is, doesn't it, Ruth?
I mean, the audience went along and they knew what they were going to as well. I mean, your intrepid reporters in the third from front row both shut their eyes hard.
Well, there's one particular bit involving
a
Tom.
Because it does everything a horror movie should do and what you would expect of a horror movie. It's all about from a boat, halfway, maybe a little bit less in. It really is a chase movie with sort of semi-naked girl racing around ship, clocking Tucker, then, leaving him for dead, trying to escape. But guess what? He's not dead. He reemerges.
That has never happened in the history of cinema.
This isn't it's full of extraordinary twists like that.
I tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to play a very brief clip from it. And I think this occurs quite near the beginning. Let's just play the clip first.
I can't do it. I can't.
Not yet, you can't. Because there's still one thing we need to take care of. Now listen, this is a very special ancient relaxation practice that was taught to me and took many years at sea to master. If you'll just go with me here, I promise you it'll help. Now close your eyes. Take a big, deep inhale. And out. And in. Shark, do, 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 baby shark, do, 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 baby shark, do, 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 baby shark.
No.
Baby shark, do, do, only works if you sing along.
I can't.
Baby shark, do, 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 baby shark. Come on, Heather. Baby shark. Here comes mommy shark, do, 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 mommy shark, do, 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 mommy shark, do, 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 mommy shark.
Can I apologise to every parent who's currently listening to Arena?
It's triggering for me, actually.
Well, who hasn't stabbed the off button immediately the moment they heard that term. We're genuinely sorry. Ruth, you felt that this is the sort of film that's best experienced in a cinema, I suppose, like an awful lot of this kind of schlocky horror is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what kind of sad loner watches this on telly at night on their own? You need to go with somebody who's going to grab your arm and screech when all the very predictable moments occur. But there's still a shark, like, you know, you still don't quite see it coming. And that's why it's a good movie, if you like horror movies. Personally, not my cup of tea at all. So I didn't have a very good evening yesterday evening. But I think, you know, if you know what you're going to, you put your money on the table and you go, this it works as a horror movie.
I'm one of those people who, I'm very open to the idea of horror movies. My wife loves horror movies very much. Jump scares, after a while, I am that person sitting behind his popcorn going, oh no.
Yeah.
This is not that,
it's
really.
It's not too bad on that
no,
one.
It's not, no, it's not. There is one moment that we discussed off air there, but it, as I said at the start, it knows exactly what it is. Fans of sharks might be disappointed because they don't appear that often, but the premise, crazy the premise, but it's sort of, it sort of works. Jay Courtney is good, I have to say. He has to carry the film, and he is not really over the top hardly ever, apart from one or two moments.
Apart from that moment that we've just played.
That moment that we saw. And so
if people have seen the trailer, they will have some sense of what that might be.
Yeah, and it draws you along. I don't particularly enjoy gore. It must be something wrong with me. It's a personal failing, and it was a bit gory at certain moments. But it's funny as well. You're talking about the communal thing in cinemas. A lot of people were laughing, as Ruth was saying.
People so, do laugh in horror films.
Yeah, they
it's
do.
A kind of release, I think. I don't
it's
think
it's
actually because it's
film.
Funny. Yeah.
There is an element of sometimes when films, and is this one of those films that leans quite heavily into the schlock, leans very almost to the point where it's come out the far side.
Yep.
And those tend to be, at least from my experience, the sort of films where people will have that release of laughter during it. Is this one of those films?
Absolutely it is, yeah, absolutely. It's not to be taken seriously, and it wasn't made to be taken seriously. I wouldn't think it costs much. It's very efficient. It's all right.
Yeah, and it references all your favourite horror movies. You know, obviously Jaws.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I was thinking Peeping Tom, the Michael Powell film, because in
that
film,
yeah.
He, the creep at the heart of it, films young women at the point of their death because he wants to see what it's like when someone's dying, and it very clearly references
and there begin
that.
And end the comparison, the similarities. But
obviously Peeping Tom is a masterpiece. This isn't quite
lest we think that you're going to start comparing it to Peeping Tom. Marks out of five from both of you?
2.5 for me.
I give it 3 shark's teeth.
3 shark's teeth is what you're getting. Okay. Our second film tonight is The Encampments. It's a new documentary from Kai Pritzker and Michael T. Workman about the students from Columbia University in New York City who occupied part of the campus protesting against the Israeli Defense Forces actions in Gaza. What I might do is start with a clip, because the clip we have here comes from very, very near the beginning of the film, and it sets up the media reaction at the time.
Thank you all for being here today. We have several members of Congress here. Throughout history, Columbia students have contributed to the great storybook of America's life and thought. The cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by radical and extreme ideology. Anti-Israeli encampments are popping up in universities all across this country.
We're here to discuss the little Gazas that have risen up on campuses across America. These little Gazas are disgusting cesspools of anti-Semitic hate, full of pro-Hamas sympathizers, fanatics, and freaks.
There was a very concerted effort on behalf of members of the media to portray things a certain way and refuse to discuss Gaza.
They see something on TikTok and they're like, Israel bad and Hamas good.
Can you believe they are chanting about the Intifada in New York City?
I really believe they are brainwashed.
I mean, this is literally like a demonstration in Tehran.
This is terrorism. The war on terror has gotten to U.S. campuses.
Yeah, we're all nodding our heads.
Yeah, there's the real horror.
Say about that.
And all of those clips coming from your favourite US television network, or most of them. Ruth, this is a very heartfelt documentary about, I mean, a piece of history that's so recent. We're talking about last year.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, the two documentary filmmakers, Pritzker and Workman, were embedded with the students. They spent 12 days on the campus at Columbia. So the film is very immediate. It has an immediacy to it because they're just capturing events as they happen. So you have the setup that you've just played, and then you're in with the students. And, of course, one of the reasons for rushing it out is one of the key interviewees is Mahmoud Khalil, the student who has subsequently been arrested by ICE and is in detention in Louisiana, despite the fact that there's no reason. And so they wanted to get it out there in part to show, you know, that he was. Also the other two, Grant Milner, who's Jewish, and a very articulate young woman called Tsueda Polat, who had gone to Columbia because of its scholastic record on human rights. So it's foregrounding these three really reasonable students who are articulate, they're educated, they're Columbia students after all, and they are not crazed. And so the documentary immediately juxtaposes the kind of thoughtfulness of these students mm-hmm. with the environment around them, which is, of course, the environment of today still, even if the Gaza protests have ended. I mean, it's still that articulation of hate.
I hesitate to use the words important and necessary, but I'm going to use them anyway, counterpoint to what people were seeing on certainly US TV networks, because pretty much all you would have seen of these protests at the time were talking heads like the ones we've just heard, or you would have seen the intervention by the NYPD.
Yeah, two times.
And so therefore this shows us what was happening in and around that, although it does also show us those as well, Paul. I mean, it was a peaceful protest.
Yeah, it was a peaceful protest. Occasionally some of the protests that it then provoked were not peaceful. There were definitely some anti-Semitic moments in some of those other protests, but by and large, there were not. What really interests me about this, it has, as Ruth said, to some extent been overtaken by events, but it's interesting nonetheless, it has no perspective on it. So it's like taking you back to it, to that whole febrile time. But the interesting thing to remember is this is the Biden administration. And time and again, you see this all the time, the criticisms of the Israeli state and of Netanyahu were conflated with anti-Semitism. This happens all the time, everywhere. And it is so dishonest intellectually. And so and in America, it's sort of times a thousand, and some of the stuff that we heard in the so-called commentary in that clip you played at the start, just this rabid response to something and this official incapacity to deal candidly with the Middle Eastern situation in America for fear it was an election year, we don't want to upset the Jewish vote, etc., etc. So all of that behind the film was very interesting to me.
Ruth, it's very much a film that is set to counterbalance narratives that may be elsewhere. It wears its heart and its politics very much on its sleeve. Do you think that it means that therefore you get a problem in assessing the impact of the film as a whole?
Well, of course, we have a problem in assessing the impact of the protests as well. And I think that if there is a weakness in the film, which is quite short and maybe could have drifted to another 10 minutes longer, it's in its urgency, it doesn't stop to reflect. And it doesn't stop to ask that question, how efficient are these protests? And you've got Khalil, two cameras, saying towards the end,
who's very impressive.
He's very impressive. He's great. I mean, you just admire him so much. But he's saying to camera, I think we're going in the right direction. I think, you know, Gaza will be free. And yet we know now that's far, far from it. So I think that
Their impact is very hard to assess.
It is hard to assess.
And also, that we were saying, outside, that there's always a performative aspect to student protests. You know, it's very heartfelt.
It's fun, isn't it? It's
also
fun to
protest. You know, you're knowing your parents and your lecturers, and that's all terrific. So it was all of those things. But as you said, Rick, it was peaceful, and the response that didn't happen at Columbia during the Vietnam War. Never mind now. So the response was quite shocking, I thought.
Yeah, it's one of those things that they come to in the film because they show clips of a film that's being shown to the protesters who are there about protests during the Vietnam War, and then they talk to some of the people who were involved in that. It gives it an interesting perspective.
Absolutely, it does, yeah.
It shows that Colombia has always been at the heart of these protests, that in a sense, its elitism attracts headlines in a way that maybe another university wouldn't. And yet, you know, we know that Columbia was one of the first to crumble when Trump
You're getting to the nub of the problem, which is who these huge universities are funded by now and the strings that can be pulled to make them.
Yeah, because they make it really, really clear that it's not the direct investments that they want revoked. It's the indirect that they want them to divest from.
Yeah.
And those are massive.
Mm. It's the sort of discussion that unless you watch certain episodes of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, that you might not necessarily understand that that's how quite a lot of universities in the United States work with that kind of backing. And they feel like they have to be very careful about that.
It's been happening for a long time, but I think the private sector's access to politics in America has grown and grown and grown, so that there are consequences now that there weren't to who you're funded by.
There are a number of very powerful moments in this film, but I think that none of them more so than about three quarters of the way through the film, there is a phone call with a six-year-old girl in Gaza who they choose to rename Hamilton Hall after they've taken over that on campus. And it's played entirely to a black screen, simply with the words and the voice of the girl. It's very hard going.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the car that she's been travelling in has just, every other member has been killed. She calls the emergency services in Gaza and they say, hold on. She's saying, I'm terrified. And they're saying, hold on, we're coming to you. And then we learn, and this is, as you say, all shown on screen. And then we learn afterwards that as the ambulance came towards the car, the Israeli troops shot on the child and on the ambulance drivers and both were killed. And so they named the hall after her, Heinz Hall.
Yeah. The story has moved on almost immeasurably since the protests last year when all of this filming was being done and the position of third level institutions in the United States, it's become far more precarious, pressurized in the interim. So what do you think it will be like for an audience to watch this film now, knowing full well what they're seeing in the news every day?
I think it will give context. I think it would be very good to watch it. And actually one of the more shocking moments in the film was settlers on the Israeli settlers cheering at universities being blown up in Gaza. So universities are at the heart of this whole thing. And as Ruth said, yes, Harvard has for the moment stood up to Trump, but a tremendous amount of pressure and leverage is now on them.
Yeah, if you want to dismantle democracy, one of the first targets is the university
education
sector.
Yeah.
Just to finish, Paul, you felt that maybe it treaded a little bit too carefully as it unfolded.
Yeah, in the sense that its sympathies were very clear. As Ruth said earlier, it has no perspective. It's happening in real time. And maybe it could have dug a little bit deeper into what was going on in the motivations, but perhaps it didn't have the time. But nonetheless, a very interesting watch, I felt.
How many stars?
3.5.
I give it 4.
I'm never going to get the chance to do this again for a little while. I'm going to give it 4 as well. I think it's a fantastic piece of work. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do that, but I just have.
Yeah.
I think people should see it if they get a chance to. And I think it's getting a release outside of the normal lighthouses and IFIs. I think it's being seen in other cinemas around the country.
And I'm sure it'll be shown in universities and student groups, you know, too.
Our final film this evening is Goebbels and the Führer. It's a German film exploring the pivotal relationship at the centre of Nazism. Paul, the dying days of the Third Reich, no one's ever made a film about that before.
No.
Either in documentary or in drama, but they choose to start it here.
I mean, it's been said in reviews of this film that, like, is there anything new to be said? And no, probably, but it has an original tack in that it's actually not that interested in Adolf Hitler, particularly, who's kind of like he's in it, but he's not the central character. The central character is Joseph Goebbels, his propaganda minister. And we were wondering, they were talking outside. I always wonder with these people, having read a fair bit about this, who were the real believers in the nonsense that Adolf Hitler was peddling. Obviously, we know that Hitler was, but Joseph Goebbels, it strikes me, he was a really good propagandist and communicator. I think he probably would have worked for anybody. He probably would have worked for Stalin if he'd got that gig. But so it's all about him, and this is a drama. It's very nicely interwoven with the odd moment of actual footage that fits in very seamlessly, doesn't jar, and makes you believe in what you're being told. And so it starts in the bunker No spoilers in any of this. When Goebbels and Magda decide to, you know, kill their children, their six children, and then themselves, in what seemed like the ultimate act of loyalty to the Führer, but may have been cowardice actually, because the Russians would have got to Goebbels before anybody else. But then it goes back to this, to 1938, really, and to how he was determined to become central, really the second in command, which he eventually did manage to do, and how good he was at his job, how he despaired sometimes of the Führer's decisions, for instance, his great idea of invading Russia in 1942. And also at the same time, the contradictions between the public image he and his family portrayed and his private life, because he liked actresses and ladies and so forth.
Ruth, this was a controversial film when it came out in Germany.
Yes, it was. And there's been a tradition. I don't think it's a law, but it's certainly an entrenched tradition that if you are in Germany, that if you are making films about the Third Reich and about the Second World War, you only make it from the perspective of those who suffered, from the victims, and that you do not show or portray dramatically those characters who inflicted this horror on you know, so many people. And so the decision to have as the central characters Goebbels, Hitler, and so on, was taken very, very badly in Germany by certain in certain quarters, and there was a lot of disquiet when the film was first shown last July about, is this where we're at? Now, I think it is, you know, misplaced disquiet, because, you know, just as you were saying, the film, you know, Hitler is—he's barely humanized in it. I mean, he's—you don't really come out knowing much more about him.
No.
And there's certainly no sort of fetishization.
No. One of the strengths of the film is that you probably see him as the people who worked with him saw him. You know, as kind of a sort of this kind of, at times almost reasonable kind of person looking to solve problems. The only problem was that those problems were like getting rid of Jewish people across Europe and so on. So you do get, it feels real, I suppose you could say.
It does, it? Yeah. And I mean, they have taken much of the kind of conversations from documentation of the day. So even though they're actors with lines, these are lines that actually existed in time. So there is, again, as you're saying, as with that use of documentary footage, which they very seamlessly blend in, there is that sense of, yes, you are actually happening. You are actually watching something that happened. And you know, we've been brought up on this story, but generations haven't, you know.
No.
So, and I think it's always a good idea to remind people about it.
I think one of the questions I'm interested in is that, given that you are dealing with the perspective of the worst possible people, does it make the film a bit of a drudge? I mean, obviously you have nobody you can feel emotionally connected to, or nobody who is
I think I think it's possible at a stretch to feel emotionally connected to Magda, because I'm saying at a stretch.
With shaking your head.
She was socially ambitious. In another era she would have been, you know, the best tea party hostess in Dresden or somewhere, but she happened to be involved with this lot, and she was very successfully turned a blind eye to this, that and the other, and ultimately to her husband's many infidelities, and she became enchanted by the sort of glamour of it all. It doesn't, by the way, it doesn't, there's a bit where they use music, is it still an act because I can't remember, and you go through these very grisly images of the early part of the Holocaust, when they hadn't figured out how they were going to get rid of, there's a piece of dialogue where somebody says, oh, at that rate we'll only kill 500,000 between now and the end of the year, so we have to come up with something more. So it doesn't shy away from what's happening, and it does remind you of it quite constantly. But what it's really interested in is how it was all organized, I suppose.
Does it ever fall into the downfall rabbit hole, where all of a sudden you realize you're looking at Bruno Ganz and a million memes on the internet?
No, I have to say, not really. No,
no, I don't think so. I think because the actors are not very actorly.
No,
and they're also not. Well, they're not to us familiar. Bruno Ganz, you know, everybody had seen Bruno Ganz in the past. Wings of Desire or whatever, and so they are. I think the actors are making a huge effort to stand back from their camera, or just to kind of blend with their characters.
And
in
to not
a way
be knowing about their right. characters, to not ruin it by being
And
knowing.
You're not saying, oh, that's an amazing bit of acting, because you have that sort of kind of reality effect going. I mean, I did find from time to time a little dull.
Oh, did you? I have to say I didn't really.
I just thought, oh, because
I, thought it was a
because
laugh,
I, didn't, I wasn't looking for jokes, but I did find, because you can't identify with anybody.
No, and it is grim, but I found it interesting because it was telling me something new. And the actor, Robert Stadler, who played Goebbels, he really had observed him well.
Yeah.
Because he does a bit of public speaking at one point, and yeah.
Okay, let's get marks out of five.
4 for me. I thought it was pretty well done, I have to say.
I was a 3.5, but I still think it's admirable.
Okay, those were our three films this week. Thank you so much, Paul and Ruth. Thanks so many for coming to join us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Now, my next guest is one of our finest musicians, who's continuing a tradition of music which has been passed down over centuries. He's sitting across from me now, holding his beautiful fiddle, a 10-stringed instrument which he calls the Hardanger d'Amour. I am going to ask him about that. He's been part of hugely successful groups such as The Gloaming and This Is How We Fly, as well as collaborating with some of our finest traditional musicians. But next month, Caoimhín O'Riála will be performing solo as part of the Cairde Sligo Arts Festival in a special concert at Mark Rhee Castle. Caoimhín, thanks a million for coming in and joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Tell me, you're going to play for us this evening, but maybe just to begin with, talk a little bit about how much of your time, your life that you've spent playing with others and learning from them and collaborating and responding, and how that kind of leads you to where you are now.
Well, I suppose I'm playing since I was a child, and quite early on, my parents had a great interest in music, but it really grabbed me. And I think by the age of 6, I was demanding a fiddle, demanding that my parents buy me a fiddle, which they did, and had a wonderful education in music through various teachers. But, you know, you seek people out that you whose music hits you like a ton of bricks. And I've had many moments in my life where I've been nearly paralysed by people's music. There's kind of a before and after. When you hear that person, nothing is ever the same again. And yeah, it's been a learning curve, and I really hope I continue to grow and evolve and change throughout the rest of my life as well.
I'm interested to know, is there a line between those people in terms of who they are, and who are those people that just stopped you in your tracks?
Well, one of them would be Tony McMahon, who worked in RTE, of course, for years, but he played the accordion, a very powerful musician, and well, I suppose the hair would stand on the back of your neck listening to him. To this day, I think there's some extraordinary recordings of him. Ignoc na Gri would be probably my all-time favourite traditional music album, himself and Noel Hill. But it was wonderful to get to know him a little and ask him questions like, how do you make music that moves people? And to hear his thoughts on that, and have him introduce me to music from all over the world. He was very interested in music from other cultures, from minority cultures, from the Arab world, from the Far East, and kind of he'd give you a window into how to appreciate that music and value it as much as our own.
I was sitting here a little earlier while you were doing your sound check, so I'm anxious to hear you play something. What are you going to play for us first?
I'm going to play two jigs. The first is Winnie Hayes' jig, which comes from Michael Russell. It's a beautiful, simple jig that I've been playing for years, but it's really special on this instrument and this tuning. I'm going to follow it with another one called Clancy's Dream, or Up Leitrim. Thank you.
This on behalf of everybody who is listening to Arena tonight, including my father, who I know is listening and is going to be thrilled with that. Tell me about your gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful fiddle and how different it is to an ordinary fiddle, because it isn't immediately to the naked eye.
Isn't it something else? Did you notice a difference in the sound?
Very much so, yeah. But if I was looking at it from this distance, which is from about 10 feet, I wouldn't see any difference at all.
Well, the first clue is you count how many pegs there are, and most fiddles have four pegs up the top because they only have four strings. This one has a quite obscene amount of pegs. It's got 10 pegs. And that's, of course, you've got an extra string to play with the bow, a low C string. But there's also the secret weapon, which is five sympathetic strings that you don't play at all. And you tune them to specific notes that you want to echo, like a wine glass that just rings if you sing the right note at it. So you've got this really specific kind of echo chamber happening with the instrument. It's something that I had specially made for me by a wonderful luthier in Norway. And we call it the Hardanger de More, because it's somewhere between a Hardanger fiddle, which is this amazing Norwegian traditional instrument, kind of like we have the Illen pipes. They've got the Hardanger fiddle. They've got an amazing tradition of music on that. It has nine strings. And then there's the Viola de More, which is a Baroque instrument, which is like, you know, 14 strings or something like that. So this is somewhere in between the two. And it's just so much fun to play. There's an extraordinary range of sound from it, I think.
You've talked before about traditional music, about that being a conversation with people who came before you, and about listening to them and about learning. But how do you move that tradition on then? Does it change little by little, generation to generation?
I suppose things always evolve, right? And they respond to new environments, new people, new times. Part of it is being aware of what's being lost at each stage and seeing is there something that's worth fighting for. And to me, there are things that have been lost perhaps in the last 50 odd years, because we're surrounded by sound, and we're surrounded by music all day, every day. Music on the radio, music in the supermarket, music at home. And there's... if you dig back into the older recordings, there's like treasure troves. They're mines of fantastic different ideas that are there to be discovered. For me, particularly in the world of tuning, like the exact place that you put notes, not where a piano has them, but in the cracks in between, there's amazing room for feeling and discovery in that area. And as well, tone. I think some of the older players perhaps didn't so much perform as play, and that there's a very different psychology, I think, to play as opposed to perform. And I think, you know, maybe as adults, not many of us remember that we can play our way through life as well. But it's one of the lovely things about music, is you can kind of be a kid in a playground, jumping on slides and swings and having fun all day long.
Before I ask you to play something else for us, I was really interested about you studying physics in college. Because if you think about it, there are a fair number of physicists who have also been musicians as well. Everybody from Schrodinger to Richard Feynman, Einstein, yeah, played violin. Is there any connection to that, or is that complete nonsense in my head?
I don't know. I feel like it's really useful. It gives you, you know, studying something like that trains the way you think, and it certainly that way of thinking has informed how I think about music hugely. I kind of analyse it, and yeah, it's quite beautiful. I think fundamentally, I think you're trying to reach the same place. which is to get to the point at which ideas come into existence. So I think, you know, that's where great discoveries are made, be they musical or otherwise.
Just before you play something for us, you're going to be performing solo at Mercury Castle. Is that a very different thing than when you're playing with a group or with a larger band?
It is. It's so free when you're playing solo. Anything can happen at any moment. There's nothing holding you in place. Nobody knows where you had meant to go. There's nowhere you're meant to go. You just have freedom. You can start walking with your eyes closed off the edge of a cliff and just float and land wherever you wish. It's just beautiful. You find a very strong connection with the audience, I think, as well, because it's a direct connection, whereas perhaps playing with other people is like having a magic conversation with people that's being witnessed.
Okay, you're going to play something else for us. What is it going to be?
I'd like to play The Rights of Man, and I was very moved by your film reviewers there talking about the girl in Gaza, and I'd like to just play this, you know, The Rights of Man, written by Thomas Paine, 1791. Very important work in our world of democracies, and the idea that you can't be granted fundamental rights. You were born with them and they can only be taken away from you, and something to remember at the moment. And play this for all our oppressed peoples in Palestine and Ukraine, I think. So The Rights of Man.
Let's hear that. Thank you. That is a beautiful piece to finish with and a beautiful sentiment, Caoimhín. Thank you, Caoimhín O'Reilly. Will play at Markree Castle on Monday the 7th of July as part of the Cardia Sligo Festival, and full details are at cardiafestival.com. Let's have a listen to this.
Oh, breaking up is so very hard to do. If you really love him, and there's nothing I can do.
That is Make It Easy on Yourself, the Walker Brothers, and the music of Scott Walker, the British-American pop star turned boundary-pushing avant-garde musician who reached cult status, in my house at least. He's being celebrated this month at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. The acclaimed music ensemble Glasshouse will present a specially commissioned retrospective performance of the music of Scott Walker and will explore work from across his career with guest vocalists, including Simon Morgan and Adrian Crowley. Aaron O'Grady is the musical supervisor for the show. I'm delighted Aaron is joining me to talk all things Scott Walker. Aaron, first of all, for anybody who doesn't know, tell us who Scott Walker was.
Hello, thanks for having me. So Scott Walker was, real name Scott Noel Enger, I think, or Noel Scott Enger, something like that. And he was kind of probably one of the first put together boy bands, I suppose, of the 60s in California. Also known as the Walker Brothers. So they were kind of one of the big kind of reverse British invasion bands who went over to England kind of on a whim and just kind of took off. And after that, then Scott became, as you say, a household name in the UK and further afield, and yeah, had a number of top 10 albums. So that's who he is.
The Walker brothers, I think none of whom surname was Walker, and they certainly weren't brothers either.
Yes, exactly.
His work isn't easy to reinterpret, I would imagine. There, you know, a lot of his both work with Walker brothers and solo stuff is very full, lush orchestrations in it. How do you approach that yourself in terms of stripping it back and then arranging it for Glasshouse?
Yes, absolutely. So even though it is orchestral in nature, the ensemble, you're talking about one or two violins max, or if it's a bigger show, maybe six. But for this, it'll be just a string quartet and then one woodwind player, keyboard, bass, drums and guitar. So you're not going to get that epic cinematic feeling and that kind of space that you feel with the orchestral arrangements. But what I think you do get is a more kind of intimate feel. And as much as possible in the National Concert Hall where it will be, it's definitely, you're kind of really quite exposed, I'd say, each line. And I think it also comes down to the individual players because they all have their own line. So I think that's kind of where you kind of take comfort, is knowing the players you're writing for and knowing how they'll also interpret the music. But of course, you know, things like the timpani, it's going to be impossible to recreate that type of sound. So, you know, you use a bit of electronic instruments, say settings, presets on the keyboard, just to get that little bit of extra oomph that you need.
I'm interested in that this is far from the first time that you've done this for Glasshouse, Aaron. You've interpreted the music of everybody from Ryuichi Sakamoto to the Velvet Underground and Joni Mitchell and David Bowie. Where do you think Scott Walker fits in that particular canon?
I think he fits along quite well, and I suppose he would be, as famous as he is, I'd say he's probably less well known in kind of the general public. But equally influential, I would say, on both David Bowie and many other artists, including, you know, Radiohead and the like. So somebody who has an influence which has really permeated the industry and spans several generations as well. And I think that is probably a key part of what we do is highlighting the work of artists that might maybe only known for a particular album in the 80s or 90s, but actually has quite a prolific and illustrious career, starting from quite, you know, humble beginnings with like quite stripped back kind of singer-songwriter type music, going to very experimental stuff that you get later on in their career. And I think particularly with David Bowie, who was influenced by Scott Walker's work and then eventually wrote the album Low, which was kind of very focused on that kind of Cold War sentiment and very, very moody atmospheric music.
I'm very much behind this. I play a lot of Scott Walker on RTE Gold. I'm gonna ask, can we play not the first one but the next one, The Old Man's Back Again? We're gonna play another clip of some Scott Walker.
Great.
I've seen a hand, I've seen a vision. It was reaching through the clouds to risk a dream. A shadow crossed the sky, and it crushed it to the ground, just like a beast. The old man's back again. The old man's back again.
I love that song very much. That's from a little bit further on in his solo career. It's from the Scott 4 album. Thank you to Brona for texting in to say that she saw the Walker Brothers twice, supporting Roy Orbison and then headlining in the Adelphi. And she loved them on both occasions. Tell me about the vocalists, Aaron. It's not going to be the easiest job in the world to interpret Scott Walker's vocals, is it?
No, and it's so iconic. I was actually just watching the BBC Proms from 2015 where the Heritage Orchestra did Scott Walker, and you know, looking at the comments, it's like the only person who should be singing Scott Walker is Scott Walker. So it has that kind of purist sentimentality with, you know, the biggest fans. But I think we're in safe hands with Simon Morgan, who is a well-known baritone kind of operatic singer himself, and then Adrian Crowley, who's going to bring that kind of more gruff sound, but equally I think as helpful with the more contemporary stuff. So I think, and then we also have Lucy Rice, known as Last Apollo, who has a very powerful contemporary voice as well, and I think that is going to really, really help spread the load.
And congratulations on winning the West Wicklow Festival's Emerging Composer Award as well.
Thank you very much.
How does the composition and the work there meet your role on something like this as an arranger?
It's a good question. I suppose I've been arranging as long as I have composing at this rate, and I've been working with Glasshouse for a very long time, and I do compose music for them as well. I think the composing helps in that sometimes there's a song that I really want to do, but it's just a little bit too kind of radio ready, or it's a little bit too kind of maybe accessible. And I think like sometimes, say, the lyrics of a song is quite a bit darker than the actual recorded song itself. So I, for example, we performed a very, very kind of darkened version of Nothing Compares to You in the Guinness Storehouse for Culture Night last year. And it was really kind of epic. And I think that kind of compositional element came in there, where I was really just taking the bare bones of the song and almost kind of rewriting it. Mm. It's quite a fun part of it.
I think people, if they get the chance, should look up, I came across it today, the version of Behind the Mask, the Greg Fillinganes, Eric Clapton song that you did for the Tommy Tiernan show a while back. If you just stick it into YouTube and you'll find it there, it's amazing.
Thank you very much. Yeah, again, that's a very reimagined version of the song.
Aaron O'Grady, thanks so much for talking to me this evening on Arena. Glasshouse performer Scott Walker, and it's presented by Music Town. It takes place on Monday the 16th of June at the National Concert Hall, and you'll find full details of that on nch.ie. That is it for tonight's Arena. Paul Murnoch was on sound. The show was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and tonight's show was produced by Shan O'Gorman. Join me, Rick O'Shea, tomorrow night at 7. We'll have our Friday TV previews and the best of the album reviews, including the brand new one, their first in a very long while, from Pulp. I'll see you tomorrow.